after a weekend of collective breath holding and 24 hours during which it's estimated that more than 300,000 Massachusetts residents temporarily lost unemployment coverage, the next wave of pandemic relief is here. President Trump has signed a massive spending bill that includes $900 billion in coronavirus relief, ending a five-day standoff that he started with Congress. The bill extends state unemployment coverage to 50 weeks. It boosts weekly unemployment benefits. It offers $600 stimulus checks for qualifying Americans, and it provides funding for food assistance programs and small businesses. Congressman Jim McGovern represents Massachusetts' 2nd Congressional District. He joined us less than an hour ago to talk about what the bill means for those who are vulnerable here in the Commonwealth. And I started by asking him if the weekend of waiting on the president left him sleepless or just frustrated.
Well, it was both, because you never know with Donald Trump what he's going to do. I mean, this was unnecessary drama that, by the way, hurt a lot of people in this country. As a result of his delay, more than 14 million people lost their extra unemployment benefits. That's just cruel. So, who knows? I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't quite figure out how his brain works. But you just never know with him.
So there was no official line from the White House that you've received now that explains what the sort of the strategy was or what's been going on there?
Well, no. What was frustrating was the fact that we had a long negotiation that included his White House. Steve Mnuchin was his negotiator. In order to be able to move these bills forward to the House and Senate, you know, the House and the Senate and the White House had to agree on all of this stuff. So Secretary Mnuchin never raised any issues at all about things that the president didn't want in the bill, nor would he answer the question that Nancy Pelosi asked over and over and over again, which was, how high is the administration willing to go in terms of the direct payment benefits, what we call survival benefits? Because Democrats in the House for months have been asking for $2,000, and so we were trying to figure out how close could we get to that. And Mnuchin would never answer that question. And in fact, it became clear that, we were lucky to get $600 based on our conversations with the White House and with the Senate Majority Leader. You know, I've been on the bill since April for a $2,000 check. So none of the things that the president complained about were raised in the negotiation.
So let's talk about the bill itself. You talked about $600 stimulus checks for some qualifying Americans. State unemployment coverage is boosted to 50 weeks, although it did lapse for a day over the weekend while the bill went unsigned. But there's also in here some important measures in the omnibus spending bill that have been important to you, including increases in SNAP funding, emergency money for food banks, in fact, 6 months of funding for food banks, Meals on Wheels programs, et cetera. You know, we talked back in November when the Commonwealth hit 1 million hungry residents. Is this going to make a real dent? Is this meaningful money?
Yes, it is meaningful money. It's an increase of 15% in SNAP dollars, more money, as you said, for food banks and for Meals on Wheels. Look, we have 50 million people, 50 million people in this country who don't know where the next meal is going to come from. We had a hunger problem even before this pandemic, but it has gotten much, much, much worse. And the bottom line is the people who are now lining up at food banks or waiting for food boxes are people who, you know, only a few months ago never had to worry about any of this stuff. So, look, this is a real problem right now, and we need to respond to it. This will help, but we need to do much more. And I'm already in conversations with the transition team of the Biden administration to say, look, this has to be a priority of yours. And in fact, I've written to the president-elect and the vice president-elect that they ought to do a White House conference on food, nutrition, and hunger to figure out how we can come up with a comprehensive plan to end hunger in America once and for all.
You know, to that point, it's so interesting. You were really transparent with us when we spoke in November, and you said that you were ashamed that as a country we have not been able to make better progress against hunger. There is a new administration coming in. Do you feel optimistic that we are going to see real change on hunger policy with a Biden administration?
I hope so. I know President Elect Biden, and I know Vice President-elect Harris. They are good, decent, honorable, compassionate people. But I will tell you this: if we're not making progress, if they choose to, you know, backbench this issue, I'm going to be as critical of them as I am of this administration. Look, I mean, you know, the fact that in a land of plenty, like the United States of America, we have 50 million people who don't know where their next meal is going to come from. You know, we all should be ashamed, but especially those who are in elected office.
Let's go back to the bill for a minute. The House is going to vote on a measure to increase the $600 checks to $2,000 today. Conventional wisdom is that it is unlikely to pass a Republican Senate. I'm assuming you're going to, given what you've said, you're going to support the $2,000. I want to ask you, in all seriousness, is there a path, is there some creative path where that bill can be taken up with bipartisan agreement in both chambers and get signed by the President of the United States?
Yeah, well, I expect there to be a strong bipartisan vote in the House tonight. And all that we need from Mitch McConnell is for him to schedule this vote. And I believe if he schedules it, every Democrat will vote for it. And I think there'll be a handful of Republicans in the Senate that will vote for it to put it over the top. Now, if the president is sincere, he will then sign it into law.
What would get him to schedule it?
Maybe the president could pick up the phone and call him. The frustration that many of us had over this last week was, where the hell has the president been when it comes to increasing direct payments to people? But now that he's, you know, maybe there was a Christmas miracle or something, but now that he's finally seems to be on board, all he needs to do is pick up the phone and say to his good friend Mitch, who has done everything he's ever asked, you know, please schedule us for a vote. Let's have a debate and a vote on this, and let's see where the votes are. And I think, that we will win. I mean, look, this is the cost of incompetence and mismanagement. And we've had an incompetent president for 4 years who has done nothing, that has helped the average American out there. And he has mismanaged this whole pandemic. I mean, we are talking today, and there's 335,000 people that died. Millions, millions and millions of people have been infected. And we can't even get this president to endorse wearing a mask. So in any event, we're at a point now where he has now said he is for increased direct payments. Pick up the phone and call your friend Mitch.
So if that $2,000 were passed, we'd be talking about significantly more spending. The Republicans have said they're concerned about that spending. There is something unsettling about spending in this pandemic $1 trillion at a time. How are you thinking about that and about deficits?
Yeah, well, it's funny. The Republicans that are complaining about the deficit didn't complain about the deficit when they passed a tax cut that cost trillions and trillions of dollars that benefited millionaires and billionaires and big corporations. I mean, they don't complain about the deficit when they spend excessively on our defense.
Do you have any concerns about it?
Yeah, you know what? What I'm concerned about is saving this economy. And if we don't spend to help people get through this crisis, to help businesses and restaurants and others get through this crisis, we won't have an economy to save. And so, I think that the money we spend now really is stimulus, and it will come back to us. But we need to help these businesses and help these families get through this, so when it is over with, once everybody gets their vaccine, that we can see this economy rebound again. A good economy is the best way to lower our deficit.
So unemployment insurance will be set to expire again in March with this extension, to up to 50 weeks of qualification. There's a mental calendar that must be playing out for you now that vaccines are beginning to be distributed. I guess it's a two-part question. One, will we be able to get those extended in March if it's necessary to do so? And two, what is that mental calendar when we're no longer extending things like unemployment benefits, but instead moving back into real financial recovery from this pandemic?
Well, look, what we're doing today and what we did last week, I mean, really is a bridge, right? This is not what we passed last week is not everything that I think is necessary. It's not the bill I would have written, but it's a bridge until we get to the next administration, and hopefully we will build on it. I think we have to. I don't know when everybody will be vaccinated. I don't know when it will be safe for everybody to get back to work. I mean, hopefully we will start to get, you know, the public health crisis finally under control with an administration that actually believes in science. But until that happens, we will not see this economy rebound. You have to crush this virus in order to get this economy back on its feet again. And so whatever it takes. I mean, what we're faced with right now is similar to what we faced with the Great Depression. I mean, every aspect of our economy, every life in this country has been negatively impacted. You know, this is not a time for us to be timid. We need bold responses to get us through this so that we can, again, have an economy that can rebound, when we get to the end of all of this.
You know, President-elect Joe Biden has said, and you referred to this, that we got to do more, that this was a bill that needed to be passed, but that more needs to be done. What would be your priority in another bill that might, you know, come forward at the beginning of the new term?
Well, obviously, we're going to have to make sure that the most vulnerable in this country have what they need to get through this crisis, number one. Number two, we need additional resources for state and local governments. I mean, we have, you know, our cities and towns are dealing with, retrofitting schools to make them safer, supporting our first responders. We need to make sure that they are whole on this. We need to make sure that there's enough money to make sure that everybody can get the vaccine, and it should be free for everybody. And I think those are the places that I would prioritize. I would also say that we also need to get about the business of rebuilding this country and planning for when this virus is behind us. We need an infrastructure bill, to rebuild everything from our roads, bridges, water and sewer systems to our rail systems. We need to deal with the climate crisis, which will create a whole bunch of new jobs. We need to make our healthcare system better. And we also need to address the disparities in our healthcare system that have been so apparent in the face of this virus. We need to do a better job. I mean, there are people who are being left behind. Who are being left behind even before this pandemic, and we need to fix that, and that needs to be a priority as well.
Last question for you, Congressman. The House is going to vote today on overriding President Trump's veto of the military spending bill. Will that override happen?
I mean, I expect it will. I mean, the bill passed overwhelmingly. I have a problem with the amount of overall defense spending in that bill. But I voted against the bill, when it came before the House. But the bottom line is, my objection to the defense bill is different to why the president is vetoing it. The president is vetoing it for racist reasons. He doesn't like the fact that we're going to strip some of our military bases of these Confederate titles and of these racist titles. But it passed overwhelmingly, and I would expect that this veto will be overridden.
That's Congressman Jim McGovern, who represents the 2nd Congressional District. Thanks so much for joining us.
All the best. Be safe.
The statewide vaccination rollout continues, and beginning today, that includes some older adults and their caregivers. There are teams from Walgreens and CVS. They'll make 3 trips per facility in Massachusetts to deliver 2 doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to staff and residents at long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and assisted living facilities. WBUR's Simone Rios was on hand at Salmon Health and Retirement in Westboro earlier today. Joins us now to give us a glimpse of how it went. Hey there, Simone.
Hey, Tiziana.
So did it feel like a big day there? What did it look like?
You know, it didn't just feel like a big day there. It really is a big day, and for all of us. But especially for people who live in long-term care facilities and the people who work there, I'm one of those people who has to see something to believe it. And I can say that, it really does seem at this point like there's a light at the end of the tunnel. The head of the advocacy group Mass Senior Care, Tara Gregorio, said in a statement that today marks a critical and hopeful milestone in our fight against COVID as the first wave of vaccines are being administered in nursing facilities across the Commonwealth.
Okay, that is heartwarming. We spend so much time on COVID conversations. That's good to hear. So, I mean, in long-term care facilities, we just started today. Any idea of how many people have been vaccinated thus far?
I don't have the statewide numbers, but we are talking thousands. Advocates in the senior care world say that at many facilities, more than 90% of residents are taking the vaccine. It is voluntary, at least at the facility I visited in Westboro. They'd nearly gotten through the entire staff, or I should say 80% of the staff, and then we're on to the residents. And they said that 95% of the residents were going to take it. They received about 360 doses of the vaccine to administer. There was some skepticism, as there will be anywhere, some skepticism of the vaccine. But officials at the facility said they're really happy with the level of participation. And again, that participation is voluntary.
Did you get a chance to speak to anybody who got a vaccination today?
Yeah, I spoke to some of the workers who were scheduled to. One already had, the other one was about to. One of them is Julio Verzian. He's a CNA at this facility, has been for 34 years. He already had COVID, actually. And he says he was somewhat hesitant to take a vaccine that was developed so quickly, but he knew it was the right thing to do.
But I still hear a lot of doctors talk and say that's a safety. It's better for everybody to take it. And I believe in our sinus here. Yeah? I believe in the doctors and everything like that. And I say, I want to take it. I want to do it. But like I say, in the beginning, yeah, in the beginning I was a little nervous. I say, too soon.
I asked Julio Verzian if he'd had any side effects, and he said not at all. He actually had a big smile and really seemed grateful to have been among the first to get the vaccine.
So, Simone, when we started, you said, you know, it doesn't just feel like a big day. It is a big day. Older adults, especially in congregate care and long-term care facilities, have been really vulnerable to this virus. And the vaccine has been seen as kind of a literal and real lifesaver for this population. So, in general, you said, you know, a huge percentage of the residents there are prepared to take it. Is there an air of the end is near and a sense of celebration? Or you talked about hopefulness earlier.
You know, it was very busy over there. There's just a lot going on. There's a lot to take in. But the sense I did get from the people I spoke to was that there is a sense of excitement for the return to normalcy. The residents at these facilities have had their social lives severely curtailed. And this vaccine means that before long, they're going to be able to see their loved ones again, not just through a window or on a computer screen. Tiziana, you know, we don't know how long that will take from getting the vaccine to actually being able to see their relatives in person. But people are starting to feel that the end of social distancing is coming.
Simone, as we started to hear about the possibility of vaccines, it really struck me that it was a two-stage process. It wasn't one shot and done. So do you have a sense that the staff there are optimistic that the process is going to finish on time and effectively? And I know Pfizer is a 21-day window. Do they expect to have everyone vaccinated 21 days from now?
That's the plan. I mean, what I was told was that they're supposed to get the second round in 21 to 28 days. That said, I think there's a lot of mixed emotions at this point, 9 months into this pandemic. So even with a high rate of effectiveness with the vaccine, we're really not out of the woods yet. That was a sentiment I got from Nicole Murphy. She's director of nursing at the senior home in Westboro. I asked her if today's the day to start popping bottles.
I think it is, but there needs to be a second bottle to be cracked when it's all done.
Fair enough.
I think definitely we can make that happen. It's a very happy day for us. There's definitely a lot of like relief for us, but there's just still, we're not done. I don't want people to think like we get a vaccine today and we're done all the protocols and safety that we put in place. We're not.
Simone, popping bottles is going to stick with me. That is fabulous. Fantastic.
We got plans to do so in the days ahead.
Excellent. That's WBUR Simone Rios. I appreciate you giving us sort of a peek through the window in Westboro today.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So as public health officials have been reciting lately, vaccines don't save people, vaccinations do. And so we wondered, what does it take to vaccinate people in congregate care? And what if people don't want the vaccine? We just heard one example in Westboro there from Simone Rios, but we wanted to speak with somebody whose job it is to make sure this happens. Tony Francis is president and CEO of Benjamin Healthcare Center. He's figuring it out starting today. Tony, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, Tony, let's start with Shirley Nolan. She was the first resident in your facility to receive the vaccine today. Can you tell us a bit about her and what that was like?
Oh, it was wonderful. We went through a small list of people that we wanted to be the first. We chose Shirley because she has a wonderful story. At some point, she taught herself to read and write, and then she became a teacher and retired. And so she was really excited about the vaccine. Shirley had some friends here that had some negative outcomes with COVID, and so she was really ecstatic to be the first and to like kind of guide the way through getting the vaccine started. So she was really happy.
Did it feel to you like it was courageous for her to do that?
I think so, especially given most African Americans or any people of color, they're kind of scared of this vaccine for some reason. I haven't really dove down deep enough into it to find out why. But I think a lot of it can go back to the Tuskegee experiment and things like that.
And we've talked and about that a number of... No, go, go.
No, I was just going to say, and just the distrust of the vaccine coming out so quickly, like the earlier person said, it seems like it came so quick. But what we did, something different, we did some research, and we found out that this vaccine actually started many, many years ago, and they just added on to it and made it. That's why it was able to be developed a little bit quicker.
So it was built on a previous vaccine, is what you're saying?
Yes, yes.
Did that matter to your residents and your staff when you talked to them about their willingness to take the vaccine, Tony? And were you worried that that was going to be a real problem?
I was really worried. I was happy that we got over 90%, maybe 95% of our residents to take the vaccine. And I think we did that through education and awareness. We got our medical director involved. And he kind of drove it and, you know, just really took it home and explained to them in detail, answered all questions. We had a town hall meeting. He sent a letter out to all the families and the residents as well. So I think after that, they were a little bit more comfortable taking the vaccine.
So as I was thinking about talking to you today, I was thinking about what this weekend must have been like. As you knew this was coming and you knew how important it was and you had worries about whether everyone would take it and be willing to, when you sort of ran it through in your head over this last weekend as you were getting ready, is that how it actually went today? Is it unfolding the way you thought it would?
It really is. I think I got to give CVS, which is our group that we chose to work with, me and the lead guy, we were in touch starting on Christmas Eve, and we talked all through the weekend, and we both answered a bunch of questions that we each had, and then it really got scary Sunday morning when I got calls from the media and DPH, and they were just wondering and had all these questions, why were we the first, which I don't know why. I think because once the program was released, I signed up immediately to get it done. I think that's one of the reasons why. And so I didn't sleep really well last night, just wondering about this day. But once we got in and we got the team in, we started setting up the place. The pharmacy called and said they're on the way. They sent in 12 pharmacists, 4 pharmacy techs. So they had a huge team. And they came in ready, and they made us feel so much better.
That's perfect music for the moment, though.
The
don't
Rocky,
you think, Tony?
Yeah,
the...
Oh my
and we're going to get interrupted by music. That's perfect. Is that well? Okay, let's go with it. I'm kind of imagining that's how today felt when it all started to happen and people were receiving their vaccinations. You were beginning to believe that people were going to be safe again.
Yes, yes. It was total elation. It was, you know, it was kind of a weird Christmas. I think I talked to many people and we're like, it was different. And so, and then we got the news that we're going to get the vaccination on Monday. So it kind of made everything better. And you kind of get the sense of the light at the end of the tunnel. And so it felt really good.
Tony, I think my last question for you is, what do people who are not there, not in Benjamin Healthcare Center, what do you want them to understand about what it takes to do this and what it means to be doing it now, after so many people have been so deeply harmed, especially older adults, by the virus?
It is so important. I'm encouraging people to let go of their fears, trust in the science, trust in what there is available, and let's get this thing done so people can get back to some kind of sense of normalcy. I mean, we've been disrupted for nearly a year now, and it just feels like we need to do this. And if I can say one positive word, I would say just trust and let's do it, and let's see what happens after that.
Tony Francis is president and CEO of the Benjamin Healthcare Center. Tony, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
As we head into what truly now are the last few days of 2020, we're going to continue reflecting on this year that was, and what a year. So last week, we talked about the year in social media, the year in music, the year in the pandemic itself and medicine around the pandemic. Today, we're going to check the score and talk about the year in sports. And we want you to join us. Is there a specific moment that really is sticking with you? You know, if you had to write a headline for the year in sports in 2020, what would your headline be? Or maybe you play sports, you or a family member does on a local team, whether it's in school or through a league. Did you have that this year? Did you play? And how was that experience different? Call us with all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We've got two great guests to join us for this conversation. We have ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, Howard Bryant. Howard, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, how are you? You had my congressman on, Jim McGovern. Thank you for that.
No kidding. Did you hear it?
Yes. I did.
Excellent.
His office is around the corner from my house.
That's fantastic. Also joining us, as always, is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
All right. Well, listen, the calls have already started coming in, but I do want to talk to the two of you before we turn to them. So I'm going to start the same way in this conversation that I have with our other year in reviews, because it's been really interesting to hear your answers. So the question is, if you were to write the headline for 2020 in sports, what would it be? And Howard, I'm going to start with you.
Why do you have to put me on the spot? I'm so bad with headlines.
Give it your best shot, Howard.
It was survival. Really, it really was. It was the survival was sort of the beginning of all of it. And it's there's a pre and the post sort of pandemic year. And let's not forget, the entire year started off on a very sour, sad note with Kobe Bryant passing away. So that was pre-pandemic. It feels like it was 10 years ago, but it was really just less than a year ago. And so from there on, it was trying to create some form of, one, understanding of what was happening. And then two, when I say survival, I also mean the sports industry in of itself, trying to remind people that it still had value. Let's not forget, when you go through a pandemic, there are so many months, or when you get away from your routine, where it may not feel like it's the most important thing in the world. And sports is one of those things. It was important to see if people still cared about this with everything else going on.
So, Chris, I'm going to turn to you in a second. But because Howard just brought up the death of Kobe Bryant, I want to mark it, because I suspect that a lot of the rest of this conversation is going to talk about the pandemic. So we pulled some sound. Chris, you actually pulled it for us before the show. This is Vanessa Bryant. This is hard to listen to, folks. Just the sadness of it. This is Vanessa Bryant talking about her husband and her daughter's passing. They both passed away at the memorial service in February, about a month after the accident.
God knew they couldn't be on this earth without each other. He had to bring them home to heaven together. Babe, you take care of our Gigi. And I got Nani, Bibi, and Coco. We're still the best team. We love and miss you, Boo Boo and Gigi.
And Howard, staying with you just a second longer, in listening to that, I also find myself thinking how many people unexpectedly lost someone they loved that passionately this year, and that that death resonated even more deeply because we had such a year of loss.
No question. And I think that this one thing that we always talk about with sports is that sports survives on the illusion that it's important. It's really not important. It becomes important to us when you're not dealing with the real things that are happening. And I think that when you're thinking about it, when the pandemic had first started, remember, there were so many folks. I remember when Indian Wells shut down the tennis tournament that first weekend in March, the number of people in the sports world that thought it was an overreaction. What are we doing? I can't believe we're doing this. And then basketball and then baseball and then everybody else sort of got the message. And I think that what happened over the course of the year was this idea that sports has always been the game, it's been the place of our society that sort of is supposed to be the thing that brings people together, and that was sports' lane. But this year, having people gather was the problem. So sports had, as an industry, had to really try to figure out, and it's still struggling with that, how to figure out what its place is in the middle of a pandemic. I think during the summer, a little bit of the restart, despite all of the different crazy problems with it, gave people an idea that maybe we could come back a little bit. But still, I think that the games themselves have been struggling in terms of the ethics of playing, and then, of course, where sports fits in the culture with something like this happening.
So we'll turn to the phones in a couple of minutes. So listeners, if you want to join this conversation, 800-423-8255. Chris, I thanks for waiting, because I wanted to mark that moment and sort of give it its full breath. But now,
yeah,
I
do want to add on to that too. I think Kobe Bryant was one of those folks who transcended sports, that even if you weren't a huge basketball fan, you knew who he was, and you saw in the aftermath of that accident kind of how strongly that loss resonated with a lot of folks. And I think you're right on the money to kind of tie that back into, it's an experience that so many have had this year. And through that return to normalcy that Howard, you were just talking about, or at least that return to play, I would say that my kind of big story of the year, obviously the pandemic is the story, but through that, I think we got an interesting look at labor relations in the four major sports, and as they contemplated how to return to play, when to return to play, what that was going to require. You know, you saw that play out in the NBA through the bubble down at the Disney hotels in Florida, and you had to have all this player buy-in, and then compare that with the very ugly back and forth negotiation that baseball saw play out, implying that there's going to be some serious labor relation struggles in the very near future for baseball. And I think really seeing that play out in the different sports and seeing the comparison happen in real time, it's going to be really interesting to watch. Obviously, there's going to be less money to go around across all sports as we slowly kind of return. And with less money, I think you're going to see even more tension through those negotiations down the road.
Yeah. And those negotiations and that conversation about labor, it's always labor. Let's not forget that, right? When we're actually having conversations about sports, no matter what the subject is, whether we're talking about the score, the first quarter, the second quarter, or the offseason, it's always labor. And you also saw labor play out after George Floyd was killed. So you saw it wasn't just the managing the bubble. It was also,
absolutely,
what about
yeah.
the players? What are we going to do about the players walking off the court in protest after Jacob Blake gets shot? And what are we going to do that Naomi Osaka decided that she wasn't going to play, and then everybody else followed after the U.S.
Tennis
the
player.
US Open?
Just, yeah.
Tennis player, Naomi
Tennis
Osaka,
player.
Yes. And so when you started to see that, the sports leagues, especially the NFL, had to really figure out, okay, we have been the most unambiguous sport in terms of cracking down on protest. And now it feels like the world is falling apart. What are we going to do now that these players are asserting themselves? And you can't separate that assertion from the labor relations that come with it.
Chris, jump back in.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's why you saw, the response from, say, NBA players was so different from what you've seen and heard from the NFL players. It speaks to how much player empowerment there is. And NBA players, you had Jaylen Brown drive 15 hours to lead a peaceful protest in Atlanta. Over the summer and talk about that openly and post these videos on social media. We've got a little bit of sound of that, I think. Let's take a listen to Jaylen Brown talking about why he felt he was obviously within his rights to do that as an NBA player.
Being an NBA player don't exclude me from no conversation at all. First and foremost, I'm a black man. and I'm a member of this community, and I grew up on this soil, so I want to say that first and foremost, but it's a peaceful protest. We walking, and that's it.
So I think it's really fair to say that in terms of social activism, we have entered a new era from what we're going to see from our athletes, and I think it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, and for people to understand that, you're dealing with you've got two ends of the spectrum, right? The NBA is the sport where the players have the most power,
exactly,
both on the court and pretty much off of it. And the NFL is the sport where the management has the most power. So watching the way these two leagues and the players within those leagues navigated this year was actually fascinating. It's also fascinating to Tiziana as well that we were talking about these different moments. One thing that happened in sports throughout was the legitimacy of the contests themselves. Do you still feel like you're a champion playing a truncated season, or that you have some guys opting out? And did it feel like the players had won? And there had been a lot of discussion about whether or not these championships were real. And I felt like that, especially after the Dodgers finally had won the World Series after 32 years of waiting, and all of these different teams that have wanted to play for a championship. And did the Lakers, was their championship a real one? And at the end of the day, I sort of tended to agree with the overarching response that with all the things that these players had to go through, being away from their families and everything, it sort of balanced the scales. I think that the competition on the field, even with no fans and with no atmosphere and all of it, I still think that the competition was really at a pretty high level.
So that is interesting to me, Howard, and I want to go to the phones in just a second. I know I keep saying that, but I think we might be just having a little bit of a technical thing, so I'm going to wait a second longer to do that and ask one more question here. Oh, no, we're ready. Great. So let's go
okay.
to the phones now, because we do have listeners who, to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Pat on the line in Watertown. Pat, go ahead.
Thank you. Speaking of labor, I think this might be the year that we mark as the beginning of the end of traditional college sports with, you know, there's conversations around paying the athletes in some form finally, and the NCAA seems to be getting on board. And then on the other hand, the sort of corruption that was exposed by the Varsity Blues scandal, where these people are paying for sports where their kids don't actually play.
Mm-hmm. Chris, is there an end of innocence in college sports, as Pat's talking about?
I mean, we all knew that it was pretty scummy in terms of the corruption and rot in college athletics. I think that's always been somewhat in the conscious, but it was front and center. And we talked about which athletes have the power and which athletes don't have the power. Clearly, college athletes have even less power than I think any of us fully realized. As you saw, you know, the back and forth with whether there would be college football and athletes basically pushed onto the field. These are kids, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old that have a few years of eligibility and really don't have a lot of influence when you're talking about schools that are relying on this money to fund things, other programs even at the school. So I think it absolutely shined a light on something that has been wrong for a while, but hopefully, you know, something that we can deal with moving forward.
You know,
Howard,
can I tell you one thing to you on this?
Yes.
I was dead wrong on college sports this year. Absolutely. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm wrong a lot. I'm not sure I was more wrong than on any other subject than I was on college sports this year. And I'll tell you why. Fighting for amateurism is the key for the NCAA to make sure that under no circumstances that they pay players. And yet during the pandemic, I was convinced that the pandemic was going, that even they would not be so brazen as to flaunt the pandemic, that there was no possible way that they were going to try to go play sports when there were no students on campus. How could you play sports if you were a student if you're not on campus? What are these individuals? And the fact that college football and now college basketball have decided to go forward and play their sports, even though their classmates aren't even on the grounds, was the NCAA's way of saying, come get us. Yeah. We're not even going to hide the fact anymore that we're corrupt. We're not going to hide the fact that these players are generating revenue for us, and that's why they're on the field. We're not even going to think about them as members of the student body, which is all home right now. And so I really believed that they were going to be a lot more judicious, and they were going to be a lot more protective of the amateur status by not playing. Instead, they said, you know what? We need the money. We need these athletes. We need them to generate. Go play. And
I mean, you had coaches come right out and say that. It's crazy, Howard. You had coaches at Oklahoma said, we need the money.
It's like Mike Gundy comes out. Yeah, it says, we need the revenue. And for them to do that, it was essentially, it was the NCAA daring every other body, whether it was Congress, whether it was the athletes themselves, to say, if you think you can break the system we have, more power to you, but we're not stopping.
So they start a game of chicken. So what happens? Did they win the I'm mixing my metaphors. Did they win the steering contest? Is anyone going to do anything? Or did they just prove that they can do this with impunity?
Well, we'll see. I think that Chris Murphy, congressman out of Connecticut, he's introducing some legislation that's going to challenge the all-powerful NCAA. There's all kinds of the different movements. You see there are these other movements in the private sector trying to create these alternative professional college leagues that, you know, former NBA player David West and Ricky Vellante out there have the professional college league where they're trying to create a league that pulls the athletes of high quality away from the NCAA to try and challenge these systems. I think Chris is right that at some point over the next 18 months or so, we're going to see something very, very different. And if not, then the athletes have lost their last stand. I think that this is the sort of end game of the NCAA as we know it, or it's simply going to be their way of saying we won and now nobody can beat us.
So, Chris Sitterick, then we get back to the question of whether or not your players are empowered.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also really interesting because at the same time, the NCAA, I guess maybe in an effort to limit liability, they really kind of left control of what happened this year up to conferences. And so it will be interesting to see if there is a push to try to re-centralize that control, or if there is going to be all this kind of gamesmanship in these different conferences across the country, whether it's messing with the schedule or opponents or things to try to make the teams in your conference seem stronger. It just is a really – there's more than one crossroads here for college athletics, and I think we'll just have to wait and see where it ends up.
So we've got a couple of callers now who want to talk to us about sports in their own life. So let's switch to that gear, and I'm going to take two calls here. We've got Bill on the line from Newton. Bill, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. Good afternoon, rather. I'm calling because, on a lighter note, in my neighborhood, we've had a lot of young people, young kids, young adults, guys and girls who love to play basketball. And I think it was important for them to interact in their neighborhoods, like I did and like we all grew up in. And I have a basketball court in my backyard, makeshift, but nonetheless. And my son and his friends and all different ages would always come back and play in the backyard. So it was a good way to interact with different ages and different skill levels. But they laughed and they had fun and so on. So, and we would sit back on the deck and watch them, and it would be a thrill to death. So now we lost it for a bit, but played and they kept their distance in shot, but now they're getting positive about reacting, and we hope by the spring they can really gear up again. And it's just good to see the kids, and they're off their phones, which is an unintended plus. So I think it's good to cause the kids all thought that this would not affect them and so on, and their parents tell them to don't. And then they kind of understood eventually with some difficulty. And I think this is winding the curve.
Thanks, Bill. Corner. I appreciate that. Let's add Michelle's voice here from West Yarmouth. Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share that since the pandemic started last March, I've been doing a lot of cold water swimming. And it was last year. I was
better you than me, Michelle.
I'm typically happy in 80-degree water, but when the pandemic hit, I started taking day trips down to the Cape to just smell the ocean, jump in the water, and it was such a huge
bomb. Oh, man, you're talking about real
cold water anxiety.
Swimming.
Yep, it's pretty cold. But it was just such an elixir for all the anxiety and the loss and the grief and uncertainty, and I really feel that it was healthy for my body as well. And this winter,
thanks.
I've been lucky and blessed enough to be based on the Cape. So I've been actually getting in the water every day, and it's been a relief. So today
thanks
I went in, and
call.
It was 40 degrees. Thank you.
Oh, Michelle. All right, so Michelle is braver than all three of us. We're all three reacting to that. So
Howard, exactly, with horror. admiration and horror. It's a mix of admiration and
horror. That's right.
You know, it's really interesting, Tiziana, when you think about it from a local sports. We talk so much about the pros. But one of the things that happened in my community out here in Northampton, and I, in fact, on the way before we got on, I just got off the tennis court, is when all the nets came down, because springtime, you know, March, April, you're starting to think, okay, put the tennis courts up, let's go. And the way that things shut down here, and then the way that all of these different sports, you had to navigate who was going to play. And then for the kids as well, that I have so many friends of mine who have kids playing youth sports. And because they've been shut down for 9 months, a lot of parents have told me that they're concerned that the kids' love for the game and the love of competition and the love of that sort of physical routine has sort of waned, because they're all in the house and they're laying around. And so it's going to take a fair amount of time, or seeing what happens with the vaccine, seeing what happens with the, you know, how much you can play in open air games instead of playing indoors like basketball in the winter. What happens to the routine of a lot of the players in terms of the local sports? It's not just the pros.
Chris, I think you wanted to talk about that too. Briefly.
Yeah, I mean, I was just so struck by what Bill was talking about, because that reminds me so much of my childhood growing up and into high school and all that. But I was also struck as I was preparing this for this segment, I pulled a cut from a conversation you had with Needham High School soccer coach Carl Tarabelli from the fall. And I was just so struck by his answer. The last question you asked him was what he hoped some sort of return to sports could mean for kids. And here's part of what he said.
This has to represent some sense of normalcy. The fact that they know after school, whether it's remote, whether it's hybrid, whether it's, you know, in school, that they have a structure that they've always had. They can go down to the field after school, be with their friends, train, turn off all the craziness that's been surrounding them for at least 2 hours, and let them be kids again. That's the most important thing.
Chris, I want to thank you. That's a great way to close this all,
yeah,
right? So, exactly. That was Radio Boston's Chris Siderick and ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, Howard Bryant. Thanks to both of you for joining today.
Always great to
thank
be both of
you. Happy New Year.
Yeah, great to have you both. Thank you.